Welcome to Super Respectable. My name is David Lewis, coming at you from The Hague in the Netherlands. And with me, as always, is Toshio Rahman in Istanbul. How's it going, Tosh?
I'm good, Dave. I'm excited about today's episode. How about you? You must have been, it's a friend of yours, so you must have been kind of excited as well leading up to it.
I'm very excited, and I'm very happy to introduce my friend Siddharth Singh from Delhi. Sid, how are you?
I'm very good, Dave. Thanks for having me. I heard your first podcast a few days ago, and I really wanted to be on it. I never told that to you, so I was very excited when you sent me a message.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you agreed on such short notice. So really happy that you've found the time to come on. So thanks a lot. So I know that you're an expert on energy and climate change issues, particularly in your home country of India. You're an author of The Great Smog of India. Everyone buy the book, please.
We'll link it for sure. It's awesome.
Oh, by the way, I'm still trying to buy it. They're out of copies. It's so popular that I cannot buy it here in the Netherlands.
I'll send you an uncorrected proof.
You can do that. Please do. We're hoping in this episode just to have a more broad and general discussion just about life in India, what it's like to live there, the environment, just general lifestyle questions, as well as, on your area of expertise. So we'll just let it flow from there.
There's a lot going on, Dave. There's a lot going on.
And as always, sure. you'll be representing the entire country, Sid. So whatever you said, that's a billion people right there.
Yeah, no pressure.
I have a certificate from the government that lets me talk about everything in India. So
you're approved.
I'm good to go. Yeah.
we're really excited. Dave, I was just saying before we started recording, as long as I've known Dave, well, we always talk about like really strange issues or things that really kind of like boggle the mind, because we're both from a small country relatively. Canada's only 36 million people. And the one thing that we always come back to is this idea of having a billion people in a country. And I was just doing the math today, Dave. I was like, that's like for every 30 Indian folk, there's one Canadian, you know what I mean, that ratio. So like, yeah, we kind of based a lot of our questions around that and kind of tied it into your specialty of environmentalism as well and resources. So hopefully we can have a really good discussion and get your point of view, because we're just two idiots who know nothing, you know. So like,
now there are three of us. So but speaking of those numbers, India adds the equivalent of Australia's population to its population every year. Wow. So now I don't know where Australia and Canada stand vis-a-vis each other.
Canada's bigger.
Bigger. Okay, good.
Yeah, I think we're a little bigger. But
yeah, wow. I find it funny. Like when I talk to people about Canada, they say, "What's the population?" And I'll be so precise. I'll say it's 37 million. It's like a 2-year-old who says, "I'm 2.5".
Yeah.
Whereas in India, I'm gonna get it wrong by more than the population of Canada. I'll say 1.35 billion. And I don't even know if I'm coming within 100 million of the right number, which is crazy.
It's
precisely.
It's crazy. It is. But hopefully we're really excited to get your points of view with it. So, if you're ready to get started on the super respectable journey, let's
start. Absolutely. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay. I'm going to kick off with the first question, and it's very relevant to what's happening, but what's happening with the COVID situation in India right now, just in your opinion? Everything that we've seen has been through the news, but I'd love to get a local perspective. How's where you are in the country, just your opinion on things that are happening with coronavirus.
For sure. I think the situation in India is quite bad. India may just be the epicenter of the pandemic in the world right now, in the sense that we have the highest rising cases, although the cases have been falling over the last week or so. But in terms of just the quantum, it's so large that we are basically trying to look for patterns and even a little bit of fluctuation in the numbers. So we have already had over 100,000 people who have died, and this was several weeks ago. So I don't know what the updated number is as of today. We've also had a pandemic-related, frenzy by the government, where since they did not know how to react to it, they ended up taking a lot of measures that were, extremely counterproductive. So a little bit of context here. So when the Spanish flu of 1918 happened, India lost about 2% of its population. So it was, you know, India was the most hit country back then. And this happened because when soldiers were returning from the First World War. So a lot of people don't know, but India's actually fought the world wars, but not as India, but as, you know, as forces for the Great Britain, right? So as our soldiers were returning to India from the ports, they went on to their respective, you know, villages, and therefore they carried the Spanish flu with them. And therefore, you know, it spread very quickly in India, even back then, even though we didn't really have transport and, you know, mobility the same way. So keeping that in mind, the government was pretty, you know, scared that we're going to lose a lot of people again. Yeah. And 2% of India in today's, you know, numbers are way higher than where they were back then. And we'd be losing literally millions of people. So therefore, the government went for a complete lockdown of the country. So it was several weeks of nothing happening. Just the police and emergency services moving. They were hoping that the numbers would fall, but that never happened. So now we have two crises at the same time. We have, you know, number one, the COVID crisis itself, and number two, the economic crisis that resulted out of it. And I think that has hit the government quite badly and its ability to kind of respond to it, because they don't have enough finances now.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when that news happened of the Indian lockdown, it was like that night or within hours to spare, people had very short notice. So that must be so hard to communicate to a population that big. And I don't know how people across, you know, rural areas would be made aware of such a thing. You know, so, not everyone's, you know, connected to Twitter.
but, you know, surprisingly, so India is actually quite connected now when it comes to at least, you know, the mobile phone revolution and so on. So people may not have televisions or computers.
Yeah.
But the mobile network is literally everywhere. So it's a very strange situation where in this country, a lot of homes still don't have electricity, but they do have cell phones because it's become so critical for, you know, for their ability to participate in the economy.
Yeah.
And so the news of the lockdown spread quite quickly. What didn't was that, you know, the information for people as to what they can do if they didn't have, you know, any money coming in, or what they won't do if they didn't have a job. So the government had measures. Well, actually, I don't think they really thought this through properly. There was too little time. And I, in general, don't think the current government thinks things through, you know, too deeply. But what this meant was a lot of people in India who are migrant workers. So there's a lot of internal migration within the country. They were basically stranded. So they were stranded, and then the, you know, since the railways and the roadways, that is the highways, had been completely blocked, they ended up having to walk back from the cities to the villages, which literally meant hundreds of kilometers of walking, and the government still did not help them. So it was quite bad.
Wow. Yeah, and that would possibly cause more spread of the virus if everyone decides to go en masse back to their villages or wherever.
Precisely.
So what's it like now in Delhi? So what are there restrictions there for you in your neighborhood or in the city?
The government has been doing something called unlock, in quotes. So we are in unlock version 4 right now, which means that, so it's been happening in different phases, and the government probably assumed that it's going to start unlocking when cases start falling, but cases never fell. So they had to unlock, and it was a situation where cases are rising, but the government's like, okay, now you can go to your parks. You know, cases are rising. Okay, now the movie theaters are back open. Cases are still rising. Oh, the pubs are open now. So things have been opening up. And I would say there are very few restrictions now. The only restrictions are still in places. For example, planes are flying at much lower capacity compared to what they did, which means that the individual flight may still be full, but instead of four flights, there may be only two or only one running.
Right.
Similarly, there, you know, trains have not been running to full capacity, and movie theaters have, you know, they have to leave like one empty seat between, you know, people. So in that sense, there have been a few kind of restrictions in place, but not really enough to stop the pandemic or to really have an impact.
And is like, is mask wearing a thing?
Yeah, I think mask wearing is fairly common. Most people do it. And there hasn't been a lot of a lot of the United States, like Republican Trump kind of, pushback against masks. So there's been no official pushback from any quarter, but yes, of course, most people just wear it under their nose or something, which is, you know, quite common.
Sure.
It's interesting. It's really, we've been following, I mean, it seems like it's been years since COVID's been going on, but it's been 7 months and we've been following it. And I remember right kind of near the quarter mark, Dave, quarter or the half mark, that's when India started coming up a little bit in the numbers, right? And then we remember that the 24-hour lockdown, or the short notice lockdown, I think it happened twice or three times. It was global news very quickly. Do you find that, Sid, that people are very adherent to the rules the government puts out, or there's some pushback, or like what's the mentality when it comes to government policy?
So I think in general, the government does not really execute all the rules that it makes.
Yeah.
Because there's not enough state capacity to do so. So they pick and choose things, and the things that they choose are fairly well adhered to. As an example, if I were to drive around the city without a mask on, even if I'm sitting in my own car, I could be fined.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm likely to put that on. But the government also has rules on social distancing. Like I cannot physically be standing, you know, 3 feet away from someone because there's, you know, a general guideline of whatever, 6 feet or something. But in reality, no one can really enforce that.
Yeah.
So therefore, the government doesn't even try, and therefore there's no, you know, kind of adherence to that. So it really depends on what rules you're talking about. And I would say to anything that the government really wants to get done, they are able to get done.
Okay. It's interesting. Huh? It's very, that was one of the things that Dave and I talked about, is that depending on where we've looked in the world, that some places have been very, very adamant against my own personal rights and freedom. So I might be able to argue against it just because I have the right to, whereas other places have just said, yes, we'll do whatever you want us to do. And so there's no pushback. And so you mentioned like the Republicans or Republican followers in the States. And then we have some in Canada. We have some in other places around the world. So I have this mentality that in some places, rights and freedoms are not as heavily enforced in certain, especially in situations of public health, right? And individuals follow versus not. But that's really interesting in India that the government, I've heard that too. I've that sometimes the government kind of thinks through, the Indian government thinks out different scenarios, and they'll be like, well, we can really get this done if we want to. This one's sort of like, if it gets done, it's good. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But they push what they really want to push, right?
Exactly. And in general, I think, you know, the United States is a very curious case because they take their freedom a little too seriously to the extent that, I'm free to buy an assault weapon and carry it around, you know, marketplace. Now, that's a ridiculous, I mean, that's taking your ideas of freedom to a whole new level, which does not happen in a country like India. So
India.
I think India is a little more of a patriarchal family setup in a way.
Yeah.
So they think of the government also as a patriarch in a way. So the government says something. So even though it's not a China, they're still, you know, the constitutionally mandated freedom, so people can say whatever they want. But it's still not common to see that everywhere.
Yeah.
It just, it exists in pockets.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. Dave, you have the next question, I think.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I guess you kind of touched on it already, but I remember we talked at the beginning of this call about, you know, you moved back to India when you were studying in London. As soon as you handed in your dissertation, you were on the plane because the job market was booming. You said there were so many jobs going, and India was really, the GDP was increasing by so many percent per year. And now with the corona crisis and pandemic, it's really hit hard. And I was just wondering what you would say it's like in India now, with the economy. For sure, there's, like you said, the migrant workers who are going to be struggling a lot, and people on the lower end of the income scale, as it is the case here in the Netherlands, people who work in restaurants and bars and in those kind of sectors. But what would it be like for, you know, more the middle class, or, you know, someone trying to look for work now? What's it like?
It's extremely hard, and you're completely right. I think if you're in India, we call it the unorganized sectors. The unorganized sectors are those like, people selling vegetables and on the streets, or, having a a small kiosk of a shop somewhere, which is not a part of the formal economy in quotes. In India, most workers are in that kind of a situation. So for a lot of those people, they've tried to get things back on track, but at the very least, people working in the restaurant industry, you know, they are still struggling a lot. So India has also had a big growing, you know, order at home through an app kind of economy growing insofar eating goes. So a lot of people are still eating out, but at home by ordering in. So we have a lot more people who are, you know, I guess, being even recruited as delivery people and so on. But if you're in the formal, you know, sector, which includes, say, consulting companies, which includes, you know, any big international manufacturer or whoever else in the country, they are struggling and they've taken kind of decisions at the board level to not hire people for the next several months.
Wow.
If not a year. So which means that if you're in the job market today, you're going to struggle a lot. And I already see that, you know, unfortunately, one of my very good friends, her contract got over, you know, at work. It was always meant to get over in the middle of 2020. It just so happened that it was also the middle of a pandemic. And now she's been looking for work for the past several months. And although a lot of people want to hire her, but they can't because they just don't have enough resources. So I think it's India's economy has been projected to fall by 10% this year. In fact, the numbers just came out from World Bank and the IMF today. Compared to neighboring countries such as Pakistan is falling by only 1%. Bangladesh is actually growing by 3% this year. So, you know, I guess different country. India has been certainly at the worst end of the spectrum, and we are kind of struggling. Yeah.
Interesting.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have a quick question, and this was you spoke about kind of coming back to India to work after you finished in the UK. Because my parents are from Bangladesh, but I was raised in Canada, so my connection with my home country is somewhat lessened. But I was always, growing up, there was always this mentality with Indian friends, with Pakistani friends, Bangladeshi friends, their parents kind of left that part of the world, right? They kind of wanted to go to the West, they wanted to build a life for their kids and stuff. What's it like for young Indian people now? Are people wanting to stay in India, or is that idea of still having to exit, to go to somewhere else to make a better life still exist?
I think that still exists, and I don't think that'll really ever go away until... until there's perfect equality in the world, which won't be the case, right? There'll always be centers of economic demand or economic growth that are, you know, that offer a far higher and better standard of living than other parts of the world. So as long as that exists, there will be some, you know, flux. Yeah. And I think in India, it is there are certain pockets that tend to, you know, go out. Internationally, certain pockets that tend to migrate within the country, and it's actually kind of fascinating. As an example, since you both are Canadians, your experience with a lot of Indians must have been with, say, Punjabis, right? So there are a lot of Punjabi Indians in Canada, whereas people from, say, the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is a southern Indian state, they're more likely to find themselves in Houston or California.
There's diasporas, yeah.
Exactly. And it's not just from within a region, but also how the different caste equation matters. So if you're an upper caste who's probably had better access to education, and therefore you may have an engineering degree or a doctorate or whatever, so you're going to end up in the United States. But if you're a lower caste from, say, Tamil Nadu or Andhra Pradesh, you're more likely to go to Malaysia or the UAE as a contractor or a construction worker or something like that. So, you know, so this kind of outward flow of labor is still a thing.
Yeah. And
I think a lot of Indians who find themselves in positions like me, where, you know, we have done degrees that can be, used in the formal sector in India, people like me often come back.
Okay.
But I think when you move with your family, of course, then kind of move en masse with the intention to stay in wherever you have moved to.
It's interesting that, you know, with the pandemic, there's a lot of expats or, you know, people who are abroad working they're kind of feeling stranded and isolated from their families and also in difficult economic circumstances. So I was reading a lot about in the UAE and in the Gulf states, there's a big population of Indians and Bangladeshis and Pakistanis who are there. And there's not obviously the same social welfare state that there is in Europe. So basically, if they lose their job, they pretty much have to go home. So despite the fact that the Indian economy is doing quite poorly, I imagine there might even be a bit of brain gain with this pandemic. With, you know, a lot of Indians may make the decision, we don't actually like it here or away from our families. We have degrees. Let's go back home and make a life. So it'll be interesting to see how that aspect plays out. It's not really a question. It's just a thing that I
no,
saw.
No, true. I think that's a good point, because there's something that's been written about in India as well, that, you know, as the economy has been growing and as we have had pockets of economic activity which kind of mirror the best of anywhere in the world, or at least work conditions which are very similar to what you'd find in you know, say, Hong Kong or Singapore or San Francisco, whatever. So you have those kind of companies, therefore you have people actually moving back to India, especially if they're offered like managerial positions, and you can get to, say, be the CEO of a company back in India. So a lot of people do come back. But I don't know what's going to happen in this COVID situation, because there aren't a lot of jobs in India as well. So, yeah. You know, it really, I think it depends on what the balance will be in terms of where the opportunities are.
Sure. Is there, pre-COVID, let's talk about normal, was there a lot of entrepreneurship among the youth of India, like a lot of new startups, tech companies, organizations, restaurants? I always seem to read about new things kind of coming out of India that seem to do very well and grow very quickly.
That's right. In fact, I think there's a lot of entrepreneurial zeal in the urban pockets of the country. Wow. And you have, you know, a lot of people trying to do, you know, a lot of amazing things. In fact, I'm always pleasantly surprised as to, you know, the kind of new ideas that have been emerging. Yeah. You know, I think a good way to kind of observe this is to watch the Indian Premier League. So the Indian Premier League is India's, you know, cricket, annual cricket tournament between cities. And it's the most watched sporting event in the country. Okay. But when you watch it, you see a lot of the advertisements around the stadium, as well as on the t-shirts and the, you know, between the ad breaks. I would say a good half of them, or perhaps more than half, are startups. So these are startups that have got a lot of money from, you know, investment bankers and other investment bodies from, say, China or the United States or wherever else.
Yeah.
And they're really making a big bet on expansion in the country. Although a lot of the traditional companies are the ones that really have the money to spend on something like the IPL.
Yeah.
Right. So the IPL currently is, for example, is the main title sponsor of the IPL is Dream 11. Dream 11 is this a fantasy league app that you can kind of create your own team and then, you know, bet money and things like that. And no one could have thought like 10 years ago that startups like Dream 11, who nobody even thought, you know, heard of even a few years ago, would be sponsoring something that requires that much money. They're literally spending hundreds of millions of dollars over the next few years. Wow. For a startup to have that kind of money means that they're really betting big on their growth in India.
That's amazing. On a side note, well, I don't understand what cricket really, how it works and operates. So we'll have to have a follow-up episode. But come on, I'm for it. Anywhere where we break for tea and biscuits, I'm totally for. So that's okay. We're but I know it's popular.
And lunch.
Oh, well, that's even better. Dave, I don't know why in the NHL we don't stop in like halftime or done between periods for snacks as a team. But it's okay. We'll get it. At least soccer. Is soccer a big thing in India, football?
Yes, and at least so soccer has become really big in the country, especially since there's been an explosion of this professional league called the Indian Soccer League, ISL. Okay. In addition to that, there's always been a historical, you know, fan following of Brazil and Argentina in at least two Indian states. So every time there's a World Cup on, you'd see like literally hundreds of thousands of people in the jersey of Brazil.
Really?
And so on. It's quite big.
Yeah. That's amazing. Dave, next time we watch Argentina versus Brazil, we know there's a billion Indian people staying up in the middle of the night watching, cheering. That's cool. That's very global.
Exactly. Yeah.
No one supporting England?
England actually had a big fan following when I was in school, but I think persistent disappointment has led people to move away from them.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to go back to Wales. Nice. Let's move on to your area, your specialty. So I want to talk a bit about the environment. So right now, if I'm not mistaken, it's the start of smog season in Delhi. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. I think the air quality index outside is really, really poor. I have two air purifiers in the room that I'm in right now.
Wow.
So what's it like living in Delhi during this time? And what precautions do you have to take?
I think for someone who's not experienced like high air pollution, it's very hard to imagine it. Luckily, you know, recently, I mean, I shouldn't be saying luckily because like people are suffering, but we have, we have happened to have a lot of videos that have come out of, for example, the Californian, forest fires. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen what those videos are like, of course, it isn't that bad here because it's literally not burning all the way around you, but it's very similar in terms of experiences. Like it's literally smoky. You can, even though the fires are being burnt. So let me actually step back a little bit and talk about why this smog, starts at this time of the year. So India has a fairly, high level of emissions in general because there are cars and the industries and so on. Yeah. But what makes the winter smog unique is that two or three things happen at the same time. One is that the wind direction kind of changes. So, instead of bringing fresh air from or fresh winds from the seas, it kind of changes to make sure that all the air or all the pollutants in this part of the country get kind of stuck in this region. And secondly, the wind speeds fall by, almost half, which means that there's, again, not enough evacuation of what these pollutants happening. And to top all of this, there's suddenly a season where farmers to the west of Delhi, they end up burning the agricultural residue from their previous harvest in time to, put their next crop. So they have like a 3 or 4 week window where they have to kind of clear out their fields, and they find the cheapest way for them to do that is just to burn it all down. So even though these fires are happening hundreds of kilometers away from Delhi, in Delhi, you can smell, burning leaves. It's a very strange situation where for, this time period of say 3 weeks or 4 weeks in Delhi, it smells very strange. It feels like it feels like the air has weight. And so if you go running, you'd lose your breath very quickly. In fact, you're not supposed to be running. Doctors say that if you run at this time, or in fact, if you exercise in any form at this time of the year, you're probably going to be more unfit than the person who is just sitting on the couch.
No.
So this is a great season for couch potatoes.
That's just in India or globally? Is that global advice too?
That would be global advice to wherever it's this bad. But this is, of course, to this time.
I'm out for the next 3 months, Dave. No exercise for me.
Fly down to Delhi, man. I think you probably don't want to get out yourself.
Does COVID add on extra stress, I guess, to the regular smog season too? Now, as the government, I guess each year the government knows smog season's coming, so that's something. But now an additional stress is what's happening with public health and this virus. So is it just two battles on both sides?
For sure. I think the government wanted to do a lot more for air pollution this year, but it couldn't because everything got disrupted. But on the other hand, I think the smog will affect COVID in the sense that, one of the major symptoms is the falling of oxygen levels, in your blood, okay. which may accelerate or which may become more complicated if there is smoke everywhere. At the end of the day, it's a respiratory disease. Right. And if the air is not clean enough, then that may impact people more. So a lot of doctors are saying that if you have a risk of getting COVID, then make sure you stay indoors anyway, because you don't want to be exposed to the air.
It's very, very fascinating. I was listening to your TED Talk, and I actually downloaded your book on my Kindle. I read only about a chapter. I promise I'll read the rest. But I was interested in knowing, like, when it comes to environmental issues and awareness among the general population of India, and maybe acting on that awareness, what's that like societally? Are people getting to the point of recycling? Are people understanding about environmental awareness and smog pollution and all these things? Because where we come from, I felt like environmentalism was kind of more, it's a recent thing in among Canadian society, maybe in the last 15, 20 years. But it's kind of like one of those things where if you ask me, like, when did you start recycling? I've always recycled. Like, it's just been built into us. But for example, when I go to a place like Bangladesh or Pakistan, it's very the opposite. But I'm just wondering, what's the awareness and the educational level of people?
It's the same, I would say, as it would be in Bangladesh or Pakistan. Yeah. I've been to both the countries, and we're very similar in many ways. Yeah. I think in general, India's environmental standards, insofar everything is concerned, air, water, soil, yeah, it's generally very poor. Yeah. We've not had the state capacity to take care of it.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, there was also, I think, India just being a poor country, people didn't focus as much as they should have on the environment, because the focus was on, let's get jobs, let's make an industry, let's not worry about whether it's polluting, let's just try to ensure that people, you know, have livelihoods and so on. Yeah. I think that kind of got locked into the way we think as a society. Of course, there have always been pockets in the country where there have been environmental movements, and some of them have been very successful or very popular. For example, there was something called the, in quotes, CHIPCO movement. CHIPCO literally translates in English to, it's not a literal translation. In this case, it translates to like a big tight hug. But what it basically meant was that, you know, there were a lot of deforestation happening in one part of the country. So a lot of the local people there basically went and hugged a tree, and yeah, they hugged it so tight. They're like, we're not going to let you kind of cut the tree down because we are hugging it. And therefore,
oh, cool,
the CHIPCO movement became a very big thing.
Yeah.
So similarly, there have been, you know, agitations on various issues. But I think on the whole, the understanding that air pollution is a problem and climate change is a problem is now becoming more pervasive. More people know about it. And I think this is going to be, this is generally going to be a good thing over the next few years.
Yeah.
I think there's more awareness today than there was 5 years ago, for sure.
Interesting.
And I can imagine with the great smog that comes every year, that surely crystallizes it for everybody in the city. You know, how many people live in Delhi? It's a huge city, right?
Delhi, exactly. So it's in India, we have a different system of numbers. It's 3 crores in Indian numbers, which I think translates to 30 million. It could be 30 million. So this would be not just Delhi, it's Delhi. So the national capital region has like,
sure,
6 cities attached to it, but it's almost like one city. Like, at no point does a city end and a new one starts. So, yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Well, Dave, 30 million is like, it's pretty much like 80%, 85% of our entire country.
Yeah, I remember when I went to Istanbul, and Lagos was the other one. I just couldn't get my head around the populations. I mean, I was in Mumbai also for I think less than 24 hours, and I arrived at night.
Yeah.
And the very little of the city I saw, I was just completely shocked at the amount of people I saw in every street, in every corner you look, there are people. And you know, I live in a densely populated country, the Netherlands, for Europe standards, but it's nothing.
Sid, what's that like? Like, when you go out on a normal day and there's like millions of people all around you and stuff, like, what's that like physically, like emotionally, mentally? Like, how do you, is that just something you're just regular, like it's just normalized to you at this point? I remember, I went to Shanghai once, and just like Dave said, I remember waking up at 9 o'clock and going inside, and it was just people as far as you could see, you know, left, right, center. And I was just like, I grew up in a neighborhood where like I'd be lucky if I saw another person at any point, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of amazing when I travel around the world and I see places that are not as populated, and it feels so strange that there's so much space and so few people. Like I lived in Canberra for a month. I was with relatives, and there were literally days when I didn't see people, and it was very strange. On the other hand, the most populated, densely populated places that I have seen has actually been Tokyo, which is perhaps more populated, at least visually, more so than Delhi and Mumbai, because it's huge, and the number of people just never ends. Delhi and Mumbai and other big cities in India are very similar in that there's always a competition for resources because there's under provision of resources, so things feel more crowded than they should be. As an example, a city bus in Mumbai or a local train in Mumbai, a city bus in Delhi and a local train in Mumbai, they look like they're filled to the brim and people almost hanging, just to stay inside. That would not be the case if we were just able to provide the adequate number of buses or trains in the city. So right. In a city like Delhi, we have about 50% fewer buses than are mandated to serve a population of this size. So I'm sure if those buses were provided, people would actually be sitting down and it wouldn't feel that crowded. So I think, problem of crowding in India can be solved by just looking at how we can just best provide walkable spaces and adequate public mobility to the people.
Interesting.
I was just
a quick follow-up. We can provide the resources, but at the same time, land is limited, right? So like, will you ever get to a point where you not only resources need to be provided, but perhaps a form of population control needs to be brought into place, or the idea of it? Is that something in the minds of those who work on this?
So India's had like a population control program for a long time, and they've and it's taken various different forms in the country. So I'll tell you the spectrum of it. So on the one side, on the one hand, you have something called Hum Do Hamare Do, which literally translates to us two and ours two, which meant that back in the day when Indians were having like dozens of kids, they're like, no, since you're a couple of two people, why don't you just have two kids and call it a close at that. So that was the population control program that came out. Then after that, this followed into policies such as in rural India, where there are institutions of governance at the village level. There were rules where if you had more than a certain number of kids, you could not participate in those institutions. So if you wanted to become the village head, you had to have fewer than three children, for example. So therefore, a lot of people who had multiple kids either were disbarred, and therefore to the next generation it was a sign that we need to have fewer kids if we need to participate in the economy fully. So that became a thing. Exactly. It was like an incentive, towards that. Then there have been other incentives, such as if a woman remains unmarried until she turns 22 and finishes her education, she's given a certain amount of money by the government. So, and this doesn't happen everywhere. This happened, this exists in a few states, which basically meant that women, instead of getting married at 17 and having three babies by the time they turn 24, now the parents had an incentive to actually educate the girl child and ensure that she finishes her university. And by the time you're say 24, if you're getting married, then you're less likely to have 10 kids. You're more likely to have maybe two. So such kind of programs have been happening. The absolute extreme was that when India had its a brief tryst with the dictatorship, because there was a short period of time when one of our prime ministers had the emergency imposed onto the country and basically did whatever the hell she wanted to do. Her son was in charge of a few things, and he went around forcing women to have hysterectomies, those what they call the these operations where you
yeah right
just to sterilize them.
Sterilize them, right? So that was done forcibly, and of course it was a human rights violation because you can't force these things. But back in the day, that became popular among certain sections of people who really thought that we need this kind of force to stop the population from growing. But now I have some good news for you, which is that so for the population to grow, the total fertility rate of of a family, or rather a woman, should be more than 2.1. That is, if they have more, if each woman has more than 2.1 babies, it would mean that the population would be stable, because that 0.1 refers to the deaths that may happen because of various reasons, premature deaths that happen, and miscarriages and so on. So 2.1 is the level where the population stabilizes. Anything above 2.1 represents growth. Anything below 2.1 represents a decline. In India, more than half the states of the country have a population, a fertility rate of less than 2.1. In fact, to the extent it's only 1.5. Wow. There are only a handful of states that have a growth rate of more than 2.1. And India as a whole has reached 2.1. In fact, I did a few calculations, and as per my calculations, we reached 2.1 this year in 2020. And it's been falling every year, which means that over the next few years, it would be well below 2.1. It may be 1.9, before we touch 2025, which means that India's intergenerational population growth would have declined. So our population will still rise, because it means that the previous generation is still having babies. Therefore, the overall quantum grows, but it grows at a slower rate. But the next generation has fewer babies. Yeah. So the next to next generation, the population will be lower than it is today.
Yeah, and that causes all sorts of issues for the economy and government. And it's hard to wrap your head around, because we keep talking about how big India is, but there can still be a massive problem for all sorts of things if you're below the 2.1. I mean, so many things depend on it.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a big, issue that a big interstate issue that we have in the country. So it's almost like Europe, where, on the one hand, there's a few Eastern European countries, and then the Western European, rich countries. And then there's conflicts because there's a lot of migration from one to the other. Mm-hmm. A very similar situation is playing out in India, where these states that have the, higher population growth rates are also much poorer. And there's also revenue transfers from the poorer state governments from the richer state governments to the poorer state governments. So there's a lot of resentment, especially in the southern part of the country, against the northern half of the country, because they think they are better in these various metrics. So they are kind of disliking this whole imposition of the north. And what makes it worse is that north is also more politically powerful because they have more people. It's almost like the southern part of the country is being penalized for doing better at the social indicators.
Interesting.
All right. Tosh, do you want to take on the next question?
Sure. Okay. Let's move to some more things about culture and youth. So you had mentioned, said at the beginning, the system in India where the government is sort of patriarchal. There's more of a family relationship. So I know India is a country very rich in heritage, culture, tradition, family. Do you find that kind of with westernization, a lot of this is being lost among the youth? Have they kind of started to discard a lot of the heritage and cultures that perhaps your parents' generation, grandparents went through? What's it like for a young person with culture versus Western influences in India at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. There's been a lot of flux intergenerationally. If you looked at photographs of, say, my parents when they were my age, they dressed very differently. They had very different social institutions around them. They had different traditions that they would kind of adhere to. Yeah. And then if you looked at my grandparents at the same age, it would be very drastically different, almost something out of a completely different century even. So yeah. I think this intergenerational flux has been quite fast, or quite a lot more intense in India compared to a lot of other countries. Yeah. Like I still feel like when I watch Western cinema, I am able to see that, despite, of course, there's always a intergenerational conflict of sorts, but yeah. I think the parents tend to understand their children a little better. Yeah. In the sense that there are similar cultures of, for example, going to the prom or dating or things like that. Whereas in India, it's very different. Whereas in my parents' generation, it would be extremely rare for someone to not have an arranged marriage,
right?
You know, or to not marry within the caste and so on. Whereas now, especially in the cities, it's more common. It's more common for parents to know that their children are dating.
Yeah,
you know, things like that have changed, and therefore, I think the ability of you know, and in fact, a lot of parents who are too strict for their children, their children don't end up telling their parents what they're really up to, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, this ability of these different generations to understand each other and to talk to each other, that doesn't really exist the same way. Yeah. So therefore, there's obviously a change taking place, but I won't say it's necessarily losing the culture, because a lot of the core cultural aspects of, say, celebrating festivals, or, you know, eating certain types of food on certain types of days, or wearing certain types of clothes on certain types of occasions, all of that is still intact. It's just that on a daily basis, you know, they'd be wearing whatever the hell they want. And then, you know, on a festival, they're more likely to wear something more, you know, typically Indian or glamorous or whatever else.
Yeah.
So what about something that I always have difficulty understanding is this caste system. I guess as time goes on, that system is getting somewhat weakened, or what's your impression of things?
Is it getting weakened? Perhaps, but it's still very, very entrenched. So I won't be able to say that it's something that is in India's past or whatever. I think it's definitely the reality for most of Indians today.
Yeah.
It's a reality that can be seen, you know, all around you, all the time. You just you know, if you're not aware of caste, you will never see it, but if you have even certain amount of, you know, understanding or realization, you will see it everywhere.
Yeah.
And therefore it becomes so common. Like, as an example, if you pick up a newspaper, you'll always find matrimonial ads, that is, you know, people trying to have arranged marriages, and they're always very specific about the caste that they want, and there's always one small section at the end which says caste no bar, where the progressive families that don't care about caste or religion. But that section is like literally 10% or less of the whole real estate of the newspaper.
Yeah.
That's just one example. And then, you know, various other things. For example, the historically most socio, politically and economically advanced castes were Brahmins. And if you look at, say, a panel discussion or a newspaper editorial board or something like that, you will see like 9 out of 10 names would be Brahmins. Even today, even though in terms of population, they may be a minority, maybe 10 or 20% of the country.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that if you know where to look, you'll see it everywhere. And otherwise it may not be as visible as it was.
I was wondering, like, when you mentioned, the reason I brought it up was you said like dating is a bit more liberal now, and quite a lot less arranged marriages. So in my mind, that would allow couples to choose each other, and they wouldn't necessarily be looking out for the caste. Or is that not the case? If you're dating in India, is that playing in the mind of a young person about what caste they're going for?
It's not in the minds of a young person. But when it does go into the minds of a young person, it's only because, what will my parents think?
Right.
When it eventually comes to that point. So, you know, I think, again, there are different realities in the country, right? I think in the case of India, if there's anything that you can say about the country, you could say the exact opposite thing, and that would also be true.
Yes,
right?
That's a good point.
So there's just so much inequity. You in cities, in certain pockets in the cities, these things don't matter. And you could, you know, like inter-caste marriages may be quite common. At the same time, even today in 2020, in certain pockets of the country, you will find cases of honor killings because of caste. Whereas, you know, especially the India's most marginalized and oppressed communities are called Dalits. So Dalits are, you know, they've been historically oppressed by all the castes that have been in the order of rankings above them, in courts above. So what this has meant is that whenever a Dalit boy or a Dalit girl ends up falling in love with someone else, there's always resentment. And in certain extreme cases, there's also violence. Yeah. That also exists, and it's still 2020, and we are still in that kind of a situation.
I'm fascinated with the idea of an arranged marriage versus a love marriage, right? And Dave, do you know what that is? Do you know what a love marriage is?
What?
Dave's so white, so I'm sorry, Sid. We got to explain everything to him.
Yeah, exactly.
A love marriage is what is the opposite.
For me, that's a normal marriage.
Yeah, that's it. It's the two people who've met without like being arranged. It's the default in where we grew up in our country.
Yeah.
So like. I grew up in a pretty liberal household. So like I've heard about it and stuff, but like, I'm fascinated this idea of like people still kind of having to go through arranged marriage. If that's what they want, totally cool. And love marriages. What are young people doing in India now? Like, are they sort of like, we don't want the arranged route anymore. We want to choose, or you kind of touched upon this, or no, we need mom and dad's help. Like, or are some people are like, I never want to get married. Like, what's the whole idea with courtship and relationships and dating? I know you can't speak for a billion people, but like, what are young people thinking in that part of the world? Because it's really interesting where I come from. A lot of people are now going towards, like in the Desi community, Indian, Bangladeshi, Pakistani, it's not working out for them, the other option. So they want to go, mom and dad, can you help me find out? Or can you get a matchmaker or whatnot? What's happening in India?
I think it's quite similar in especially the urban metropolitan kind of communities, in the sense that a lot of the kids who don't end up finding people, from their universities or their, workplaces do end up relying on their parents to find someone.
Yeah.
But I think the rules of engagement have changed a little bit. You'd find, so arranged marriage itself has transformed, right? Like,
yeah.
So I come from a village. Like most of my family is in a village in Rajasthan, which is one of the least socio-economically progressive states. So it's quite backward in all key indicators. As an example, yeah. Rajasthan is the state where women get married at the least age compared to all other states.
Okay.
It's the state where most arranged marriage couples still don't get a say, or rather the women still don't get a say in who they're getting married to.
Okay.
As a proportion of the total relationships, Rajasthan is the worst amongst all other states when it comes to this metric also. So there's just two metrics that show that when especially related to marriages, India is still kind of, I mean, Rajasthan specifically is a little backward.
Yeah.
Now, in my village in Rajasthan, again, a lot of families do end up, arranging relationships. But I think there's a greater say in that, unlike back in the day when they would just, the parents of the two parties would decide and the kids would meet each other for the first time when they're getting married.
Yeah.
It's changed now in the sense that they do ask for consent from their kids, or they rather they let the kids kind of make the final decision.
Yeah.
This has happened in the case of, again, people I have personally known, like women who have grown up and lived in that village all their lives. They were not just married off to the first person their parents thought they were okay. They literally had to, wait for the young couple to at least have a few phone conversations, to perhaps meet each other a few times, and then take the call whether they really want to do it.
Yeah.
But there was still a lot of pressure to get married. So that pressure always existed, except that it's changed a little bit now.
That's interesting. It's fascinating topic. I mean, my wife and I watched an entire Netflix series on it. And then
you watched Indian Matchmaking, is it?
Yeah. Have you seen it?
No.
Dave, you got to watch it. I know it's westernized and Hollywoodized and everything like that. But like, just to get an idea of it, and that's not my only source, also how we grew up and everything. And to each their own is my opinion. Who knows? Who's to say that the West has got it right or India's got it right? Because, the divorce rate in our country is like 50%, right? I'm assuming in India it's less than that, but growing.
It's much lower, but it's growing. But you know what? Again, it's one of those things which, where a lot of times relationships that should have broken down don't.
Yeah.
Because the woman is being subjugated in some form. It's usually what happens is in India, if a marriage breaks down, the woman is still stuck at home doing the homely things, whereas the man is doing whatever the hell he wants, because he probably has a job somewhere and the social experience is very different. In a Western country, that would have led to divorce, and the woman would probably have, you know, more freedom to pursue a second, you know, relationship with someone who she really likes. In India, that may be much harder to do. So I don't necessarily think that a low divorce rate is good. I think a divorce rate should be, it should reflect the needs of the society, as opposed to, you know, just being high or low being a good or bad thing. Maybe if it's too high, there could be other social issues that need to be addressed. Yeah. Maybe that's something that, you know, a few Western societies need to think about.
Yeah.
But in India's case, for sure, I think it's too low because women are not able to get out of marriages that they should be able to get out of.
I want to bring it over to your experiences living abroad, because yes. You've lived in the UK, Germany, and I think briefly in Norway, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yes.
When you moved to London in 2010, that was your first time like properly living abroad. Is that right?
That's correct.
So how did it feel for you? Did you get culture shock, and what aspects of it really like were striking for you?
So I don't think I had a major culture shock when I moved to London. I think I guess our experiences of the world are very interesting in that sense. So I was shocked by the fact that I did not have a culture shock. It felt very natural. Mm. I did have a culture shock when I moved back to India, because I went straight from London to my village. Like I stopped, you know, my flight landed in Mumbai, and then I kind of moved to my village straight after that. And just a reminder of the grave differences between this and that, it struck me again in a way that was like, oh my God, like this is the reality that people have to live. Yeah. And it's still like this conservative, or there are still these, you know, social issues, which I never had to think about when I was in London. I think one of the reasons I did not have a culture shock when I moved to London was because, although India is very different from the United Kingdom, but I've always lived in a big city within India.
Yeah.
And my immediate social surroundings within Delhi or Mumbai or Hyderabad were not that different to what it was in London, in the sense that, you know, the same kind of say interpersonal relationships, the same kind of you know, the same culture at work or at university. What was different was how you deal with the whole world, which, you know, in I think in a country like India, you may have more people ready to stop you and, for example, ask you how much you earn, or ask you why you don't have a baby. You know, it'd be like, oh, you're 30 something years old, why don't you have a kid yet? And they expect you to respond to them as in, I don't have a kid because, and then you can't say because I choose not to do that, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, I think because it's because people are more likely to ask these questions to you, therefore the culture shock can be a little bit more when you're in such a setting compared to, say, London, where maybe there could have been a culture shock if people were more intrusive. But because people left you alone, therefore the, you know, my experiences were not that kind of, I guess.
Do you mean like a social circle, like friends in the UK are reluctant to broach those topics? Or is it just like, you know, everyday people that you come across?
It's everyday people. Like with friends, it's fine to an extent, but you don't expect yourself to be, you know, sitting in, you know, going to work in the metro or in a bus, and the person sitting next to you being like, okay, so where do you work? What do you earn? You know, like really personal questions, which are...
And that happens in India.
That happens in India. Yeah. And especially if you're, I guess the way privacy is seen is very different. It's not individuals. It's more like familial in a sense. So you could, I like, as an example, a friend of mine used to kind of complain about this a lot. He lived with his grandmom for a brief period of time, and he had and they lived in this neighborhood where everyone was like really familial with each other and very close to each other. They have kind of grown up together. So he had a neighbor who would consistently walk into his room without knocking. There were times when he would be sitting there in his underwear, and she would just walk in because she forgot something from the last time she put she put something in, you know, the cupboard, yeah. and she just picked it up and left. And he's like, what the hell is happening? This is my room. And you're a neighbor. You don't even live in this house. That kind of, in fact, they get offended if you're not providing that space to them. They think you have something to hide, and there is, you know, there's something wrong with that kind of interaction. So, but Dave, if someone asks you how much you earn in India, you better tell it to them, because okay. they will not be pleased if you don't respond.
Whenever I go back to Bangladesh, the bluntness in the questions asked to me is like amazes me. One of the first things they did, they won't even say hi or hello. If you're talking to someone you know, they'll be like, oh, you look like you gained weight. That'll be like the first question out of the bat or statement. And then like, you're like, I feel like crap now. Like, did I gain weight? Did I? So like, it's strange. And Sid, like the reason Dave and I have talked about this is that we've lived in different countries, including now outside our home country. So one thing Dave and I do is like we notice things that we like about the country we're in as opposed to things we miss about the country we're back home. So like, you know, I think one of the things that the West does really in a really negative way or doesn't make an effort is a sense of community, you know? So like India, even in the Netherlands, Dave, you talked about how in Hungary, at least you have it as well, in Frederica, in Italy, and where I am, at least there's a sense of community and you can sense it in the environment, right? People have like know each other and see each other. I mean, yeah, they walk into your bedroom when you're there. But other than that, whereas like what you talked about in the UK is very common in Canada. Nobody will even notice you or talk to you at all if unless you make the effort to. And it's a very unique thing that I think that we don't do really well. I like to know our neighbors. I've had a neighbor me in Canada for 15 years. I've talked to them once, you know, just once. And I know that's a rare thing, but that's the common. That's the default, you know. Unless you need something, you really don't talk to anyone, and it's kind of sad.
Exactly. And it's, in fact, even frowned upon in certain parts. For example, you know, in my time in Germany, so that could be considered as a mild culture shock of sorts, in the sense that nobody really wants to have a conversation when they're working,
yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I'm not here to kind of disrupt you from your work, but as an example, if you're, you know, purchasing something at the grocery store, yeah. the person who's, you know, like you have 30 seconds while you're, you know, making a payment and kind of making sure all the, you know, goods are scanned, but yeah. they don't want to have a conversation then. Yeah. And they kind of get taken aback if you try to, and it's not just them, like it could be a waiter, it could be somebody who's serving something. It's not just because they're busy, but it's just a thing that doesn't happen. So I completely agree with you. I think we don't check on each other the same way that you would. Of course, they cross a lot of lines in India, but
so, it's about a balance. I mean, yeah, I think sometimes in Canada or North America, if you go to a restaurant, it can feel a bit artificial sometimes, because they'll go like, hi, I'm David. I'll be your server tonight. How can I help you? And it's all, I can't tell if they're genuinely trying to be close to me or if they just want a nice tip at the end. Nice. Whereas in the Netherlands and also in Hungary, the serving culture is just, they throw the food on the table and you have to like go into the restaurant or like to the kitchen and ask for some service. And it's all about a balance. I think I appreciate the bluntness and the directness of the Dutch, because then I know that they're not really hiding anything. They're just being themselves.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Exactly. I was watching this documentary where they got a few people from refugee camps in sub-Saharan Africa to move to somewhere in the middle of the United States, and so there were a few brothers who were moved together to one city, and they were put in one house, and it was part of a rehabilitation program. Yeah. And of course, the first jobs that they would get would be in the service industry, or you know, simple tooling and so on. One of the big shocks for them was that, why do people smile so much when they're not really happy? You know, and like you've just met someone, and someone saying, "I'm you know, I'm so happy to meet you," or "I'm so pleased to meet you." Like, why
do you know?
Yeah, you just met me. Like, why are you happy? So, I think that's a point well taken. We have trained ourselves in a Western setting to be warm to others in a way that expresses like a big smile or you know, some form of a greeting, which may not always be what you're thinking or what you're feeling. And maybe in other cultures, they may respect that inner feeling more than they do your outward appearances.
Yeah, I think inevitably, in my experience, you know, Canadians worldwide are known to be nice, but I'll be honest, I think Canadians are just like anybody else in the world. They're just people. They're very nice. You know, if you meet them on the street, you know, they'll go, hi, how are you? But, you know, you know, the personality comes out in the end. And sometimes this desire to always be nice and smiling, it'll come out in a different way, like passive aggressiveness or some kind of very strange interactions at work where they're kind of almost killing you with kindness. So at the end of the day, people are people. But what I did want to ask you about was, it's kind of interesting for me, is I was only in India for about a week and a half. And I was somewhat adventurous with the food. I do like Indian food, but, you know, I grew up on Canadian Indian and British Indian food. So I wanted to get your perspective on what you thought of the food in the UK, and if you tried much.
It's one of those memes that go around, right? Like, you colonized the whole world for the spices, but then you failed to kind of incorporate
use them. Food.
Exactly. So what was the point of it all? You know, I think in general, that's the one thing that I truly cannot appreciate of European food. I think it definitely lacks a certain zing to it, which you can only get with certain forms of spices. And I don't necessarily mean that in a way that you need to make it very hot to the tongue. I think it can be perfectly mild to taste, but certainly there's something that can be done there.
Okay.
For example, Sid, you've just insulted pretty much 5 billion people around the world. So let's clarify. No, Sid. So Dave and I, say we fly into Delhi this weekend, and you're going to show us around. Tell us where you're going to take us for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. What kind of foods are you going to give us? We're going to go back and tell the rest of the 5 billion people. It's a good guy.
By the way, I don't think it's a situation with all 5 billion people. I actually love the world. I love different, you know, cuisines from around the world. I think in particular, cuisines from Western Europe and the UK are the ones that are most bland to me personally.
Yeah.
But I could, for example, I'd love Ethiopian food or Mexican or Indonesian or... Actually, Indonesian, not as much, but Japanese or Chinese. I think, you know, if you were to come to India, again, the Indian restaurants that you know of in the West are an amalgamation of various cuisines in the country.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a bit of Punjabi, there's a bit of South Indian, there's a bit of something else. In India, obviously, that's not the case, and you'll get specialized restaurants from, you know, that specific cuisine that you want. Yeah. So I'll tell you a few that in a city like Delhi that you would have to try. Yeah. So one is that Delhi has an amazing street food culture for like evening snacks.
Okay.
So these are not fully cooked meals. These are like, you know, crisps and wafers with different chutneys on it and different nuts. And, you know, so they create like a little snack for you at you know, if you're hungry at, say, you know, 4 p.m. or 3 p.m. You know, between lunch and dinner. So those are called chaats, they're very tangy in flavor and extremely delicious, and something that you always regret eating too much of, because you cannot just stop with just having one bowl of those things.
Okay.
So that is one thing that you'll find in a lot of parts of the country, but in Delhi especially, something to try. The second is that there's a culture of Mughalai food. Now, Mughals were the sets of invaders who came into India and then stayed on in India, and basically the Indian Empire was the Mughal Empire for a long period of time before the Britishers came in, you know, as a part of the East India Company.
Yeah.
So the Mughal cuisine is cuisine that is that has influences from Persia and Central Asia, and therefore that has a lot of, you know, a lot of similarities with even Turkish food. So in fact, it's kind of funny, when I you know, when I've been to Istanbul, there's so many names that are so familiar, because we do the exact same things, but we just call it by a different name or something very slightly different. For example, in Istanbul, it's very normal to find kofte.
Yeah.
Right. And I've been eating kofte all my life in India, and my mother used to make it at home, and she still made. So if I told my mother that a kofte actually came from Iran or Persia or wherever else, she'd be like, "What the hell are you talking about? I've like my grandmother used to make it in India." Yeah. You know, so there's a set of food that's called Mughalai food, yeah. which is rich in protein, a lot of, you know, chicken, lamb, and so on, yeah. Exceptionally delicious. And then of course there is Southern Indian food, which generally goes well as breakfast food.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, my Southern Indian friends would be very insulted if I called it breakfast food. Yeah. But what they're most known for in Northern India is for their breakfast food, which uh-huh. basically means that they're, you know, there are dosas, which are a form of crepe, and there are a few other things that kind of go well for a light but hearty early morning meal.
Nice.
And a curious question about Delhi Belly. So
yes.
Most foreigners, when they go to India, they're all terrified of getting the dreaded Delhi Belly. But maybe it's a strange question. If you're a Delhiite, I don't know if that's the correct demonym.
That is.
is Delhi Belly a thing? Like, do you have to be on your guard all the time?
No, so Delhi Belly is definitely a thing. In fact, it's very interesting. Somebody I know, his name is Krish Ashok. He's writing a book called Masala Labs. And the book is a scientific take on cooking and how cooking evolved and how Indian food is, you know, like what the logic is to why Indian food is the way it is, right?
Yeah.
So he had a very interesting thing to say, which is that a lot of exceptional Indian food is, you know, fried or heated a lot just before it's given to you. The reason is because, like, we live at the end of the day in it's a tropical country. There are more likelihoods of microbes and yeah. bugs, which form the in quotes Delhi Belly category of bugs. If you heat food well, you're probably not going to get it. It often, you know, in my experience, these infections of the stomach usually come when you have some chutney or something that is uncooked that is a part of the meal.
Yeah.
So whenever my colleagues from, you know, Paris and other places drop in, I always recommend just go crazy, have the hottest food you can, hottest as in temperature wise.
Yeah.
Just don't have the uncooked stuff. Don't have the salads. Don't have anything that may not have been fully cooked.
That's good advice.
What about like the tap water? Like, do you drink tap water in Delhi, or are you always getting big vats of?
My parents came to Germany to visit me, you know, when I was there, and they walked in with their two suitcases and literally bottles and bottles of water. And I was like, what the hell are you doing? Like, why have you been traveling around? She's like, you know, in case I got thirsty, I would need some water. I said, you can just drink the tap water. Like, that's a thing. She's like, oh, you mean to say tap water can be just drunk? I said, of course. In India, you can't think of drinking tap water. It's not a thing that people do. Or there are filters everywhere. Of course, if you're very poor, you know, then you have no choice. And a lot of people do end up having tap water. But I think for anyone who can afford it, most homes have filters of various kinds. It's a big business in India. Not just in India, but I think a lot of these other tropical countries have the same issue. Just because it's not cold enough, therefore the pipes and all of that just always have moss, or I don't know, there probably a lot of other things that I don't want to imagine.
Yeah, that's not.
There you go. I think that's a good note to end it on. That's really fascinating. So we will go to India one day, Dave, and Sid will show us around, and he'll.
Tosh and Dave, I can't wait to have you both back here. You know, I think there's a lot to be eaten. And I promise you, no Delhi Belly until the last day. So you can deal with it on the
flight. I'll hold you to
that. There you go. Thanks so much. We're gonna post your TEDx talk onto our site and the Amazon link for your book and some of the stuff you mentioned too. But thank you so much for your time, Sid. That was amazing. It was really informative.
Yeah, thanks, Sid.
Thank you. No, it was an absolute pleasure of mine. I think I've really enjoyed this conversation because a lot of times there's a lot of focus on one particular thing, and I just... This is a lot more broad-based, and I love talking about different things. So
No problem. Thank and we'll you put we'll, all the billions of people you've insulted, we'll put your email on the bottom so they can complain to you, right?
Please, and my address also. So they can throw
No problem. Anyway, Sid, take care of yourself. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Sid.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Cheers, bye.
Bye-bye.